Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Corumdale Church. And every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about four approaches to race, politics, and gender.
You might have noticed that two people were missing in the introduction because both Dusty and Chris are not on the podcast today. So we've added another friend. Our friend Isaiah Lewis. Welcome to the podcast, Isaiah.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell the listeners something about yourself that will help them understand who you are.
Yeah, I'm the church planting resident at Corumdale and working with First City Church as well in the area. And my wife and I have been married for coming up on 13 years and been in ministry up in Wisconsin for the last 8 or 9 years. And we just moved to Omaha about a year ago.
Beautiful. We're glad to have you on the podcast. I like that I just said, hey, why don't you just come on the podcast and join us?
Yeah.
And he was like, do I need to do some show prep? I was like, yeah, read this article. Also, this podcast is sponsored by Little Debbie Oatmeal Cream Pies.
Thank you, Little Debbie.
We like to have some snacks for the podcast every once in a while. And today, Travis brought Little Debbie Oatmeal Cream Pies, which is an odd choice, but also a beloved one because it reminds me of my childhood.
Do we have a jingle we can play with that?
There's something about oatmeal cream pies. They're like the only Little Debbie thing I actually like.
Don't they get you in the back of the throat with all the sugar? It just hurts when you eat it.
It's so good.
Oh man.
I used to mow lawns with my friend Dan when I was in high school. And we would mow his grandmother's lawn. We mowed a bunch of lawns down off 50th and Grover and 40th and Grover. And all these neighborhoods down there. And his grandmother lived down there. And when we got done mowing his grandmother's lawn, she would have a whole plate of these. And you could eat as many oatmeal cream pies as you wanted. And so I have this very vivid memory of every Thursday, whatever day it was in the summer that we mowed his grandmother's lawn, oatmeal cream pies, man.
Boom.
So
is that the snack you go to today?
No, I have not had one of these in years.
What do you eat after you mow the lawn now?
I haven't eaten oatmeal cream pie in years until Travis brought these in. I was like, oh, that looks tasty. I'm much wiser with my choices. I like to think I'm much wiser with my food choices now. But needless to say, this podcast is sponsored by the Gospel Coalition and Little Debbie on the Oatmeal Cream Pie. To get back to the title of the podcast, Kevin DeYoung on March 9th wrote an article on TGC, the Gospel Coalition blog, Why Reformed Evangelicalism Has Splintered, Four Approaches to Race, Politics, and Gender. What he's doing is giving us a taxonomy of kind of what has happened or what he perceives to have happened in the evangelical world over the past couple of years. And I thought it was really helpful. Sometimes one of the most helpful things leaders do is just to put language to things that we have intuition about. We're sort of sensing something and they say, hey, here's what let me give you some language to frame this out. And that's what Kevin DeYoung is doing here. I don't know if you will end up agreeing or disagreeing with his taxonomy, but that's why we're talking about it on the podcast, because I think it has been helpful to all of us around the table in just naming some things. We feel like, oh yeah, you can kind of sense this. He's putting some categories on it and giving us a way of thinking about it. You, the listener, get to decide if it's a good way or a bad way to think about it. Let me just read a few sections from this article and sort of tee up where Kevin DeYoung is heading. And as you could tell from the title, he's going to suggest there are four approaches currently to race, politics, and gender. And it's the difference in these approaches that is creating some of the fragmentation among sort of gospel-y, Bible-loving evangelical people. So that's where he's going to head. Let's see how he gets there. Here's the second paragraph of the article. My memory may be too rosy, but in my estimation, having been in the room for most of this history, the early 2000s up until 2014 saw a remarkable coming together of a variety of Reformed and Reformed-ish networks, ministries, and church leaders. Of course, there was the usual disagreements about the sacrament and spiritual gifts and polity and approaches to worship, but the team was held together by a number of important theological convictions, historic Christian orthodoxy, inerrancy, penal substitution, Calvinist soteriology, the Reformed solas, complementarianism, and the centrality of expositional preaching. Across the almost decade of apparent unity, there was also a shared sense of what the movement was not. We were not liberals, not Arminians, not emergent, not seeker-sensitive, not prosperity gospel, not egalitarians, not revisionist on sexual ethics, not Catholics, not watered-down evangelicals, and not compromisers on unpopular doctrinal truths. For about a decade, it seemed that more pastors, more churches, and more networks were coming to share these convictions. Importantly, many brothers and sisters embraced being Black and Reformed. Christian hip-hop was widely celebrated as rich theological wine being poured into new wineskins. Big God theology was not only on the rise and on the move, it was bringing together people who had previously been apart. He dates 2014 as sort of the year that that shifted a little bit. And I would have to say, having been around as Kevin was during that whole journey, being in the room that whole time, I think that's a pretty accurate sense of what was happening. We planted Cormdale Church in 2005, and it seems that was sort of at the very beginning of this kind of movement. The Gospel Coalition was formed in 2007, and there really was this sort of coming together, the way Kevin DeYoung describes it, this various churches and networks and ministries sort of coalescing around a big God theology, sort of John Piper's vision of the glory of God and Tim Keller's vision of sort of cultural engagement. And there sort of began this, and you had leaders like Lecrae and Eric Mason in the African American church. And so there was this constellation of a bunch of different and sort of divergent kind of communities, tribes, networks, churches, denominations, but sort of coalesced around this reformed-ish evangelical center. And it was a cool season of time. It really did feel like there was a lot of momentum happening. Now, DeYoung says, on the other side of Ferguson, which was 2014, Trump, 2016, MLK 50, 2018, coronavirus, 2020, George Floyd, 2020, and more Trump, the remarkable coming together seems to be all but torn apart. Obviously, the biggest issue is race and everything that touches race, for example, police shootings, critical race theory, Trump. But it's not just race that divides us. It is more broadly our different instincts and sensibilities, our divergent fears and suspicions, our various intellectual and cultural inclinations. Yes, there are important theological disagreements too, but in many instances, people who can affirm the same doctrinal commitments on paper are miles apart in their posture and practice. That's an interesting point that he's making there, because basically what he's saying is the dividing tends to be now along instincts and sensibilities rather than along doctrine. There's widespread doctrinal agreement still in this tribe, but there's some strong differences in terms of how to approach various things that seem not doctrinally central, but more cultural or more the application of doctrine to life. And DeYoung sort of wants to say, let me suggest how we could think about what's happened. So before I go further in the article, thoughts on, do you feel like he's right in teeing up that there was a season of unity and now there seems to be a season of fragmentation? Is that too simplistic, or does that seem to frame what you guys have experienced?
Yeah, it feels like he's framing that up as what happened in this group, this conglomerate of people, but also what happened culturally in societal, like societal divisions seem to be heightened beginning in 2014 and through the next 7 years.
And I would say, as someone that was not in the room for those early parts of the coming together, but watching from the outside and seeing the beauty of that and desiring to experience some level of that, there is a sense in which now seeing some of the division, there's some angst and some anxiousness about what this will all, how this will all shape out, how this will fall out, I guess, from this. So, yeah, I think it's a good summary moving into his taxonomy.
All right, so he begins his taxonomy section of the article with one word: why? That's the question he's trying to answer. Why? That's what I've been thinking about over the last year or more. I don't have the last word on how to assess the problem, but attempting to understand what's going on is an important start. It seems to me there are at least four different teams at present. Many of the old networks and alliances are falling apart and being reformed along new lines. These new lines are not doctrinal in the classic sense. Rather, they often capture a cultural mood, a political instinct, or a personal sensibility. You could label each team by what it sees as the central need of the hour, and by what it assesses as the most urgent work of the church in this cultural moment. Let's give each group an adjective corresponding to this assessment. So here's now Kevin DeYoung's taxonomy of the four different groups. And what I like here is he's going to use the most positive terminology possible to describe what each of these tribes sort of thinks is the central need of the hour for the church. So here they are. Number one, contrite. He calls this group the contrite folks. Here's what he suggests they're seeing as the most urgent need of for the church in this moment. Look at the church's complicity in past and present evils. We have been blind to injustice, prejudice, racism, sexism, and abuse. What the world needs to see is a church owning its sins and working in brokenness to make up for them and overcome them. Tribe number two, compassionate. Look at the many people hurting and grieving in our midst and in the world. Now is the time to listen and learn. Now is the time to weep with those who weep. What the world needs is a church that demonstrates the love of Christ. Number three, careful. Look at the moral confusion and intellectual carelessness that marks our time. Let's pay attention to our language and our definitions. What the world needs is a church that will draw upon the best of its theological tradition and lead the way in understanding the challenges of our day. And then number four, courageous. Look at the church's compromise with, if not outright capitulation to, the spirit of the age. Now is the time for a trumpet blast, not for backing down. What the world needs is a church that will admonish the wayward, warn against danger, and stand as a bulwark for truth, no matter how unpopular. So, to review again quickly, number one, contrite. The greatest need for the church is for it to own its sins and work in brokenness to make up for them. Number two, compassionate. What the church most needs is to demonstrate the love of Christ in the world and in the midst of people's pain and grief. Number three, careful. What the church needs is to draw upon the best of its theological tradition and lead the way in understanding the challenges of our day. Number four, courageous. What the world needs is a church that will admonish the wayward, warn against danger, and stand as a bulwark for truth. Now, here's what I like about Kevin DeYoung. He says, most of us will read the list and think, I like all four words. At the right time, in the right place, and in the right way, the church should be contrite, compassionate, careful, and courageous. The purpose of this schema is not to pigeonhole people or groups, nor is it to suggest that if we could just mix in 25% from each category, then all our problems would be solved. I realize the danger with schemas like this is that people may further divide by placing others into rigid categories, or that people may stumble into moral equivalency as if there are no right approaches or right answers. Having made those important caveats, I believe that these conceptual groupings can help us see more clearly that our disagreements are not just about one thing, but about the basic posture and way in which we see a whole lot of things. Although any categorization tool will be generalized, simplified, and imperfect, they can still be useful. So what I like that he's doing here is saying, hey, I'm not trying to, I realize we can pigeonhole people into these categories and that's not my goal, but I do want to name that these are sort of the ways that, that people seem to be approaching lots of issues. It's not just about race or about gender or about, you know, the church's role in the world, but all these things sort of coalesce into these four categories. What are your thoughts on the four teams?
I think they're four really helpful categories. And as I'm sitting here, I'm wondering if thinking of this almost as more of a Venn diagram would be more helpful than clear-cut categories of where there's, in different areas, there's going to be an overlap where someone that might be more courageous in particular areas in our cultural moment, in other areas might be more careful and more compassionate. But I think overall, just having those categories, at the risk of labeling people, it helps to have an instinct of, okay, this is how it seems like they're approaching this issue, and that's how they're different than my approach in this particular case in point.
It's interesting because he does suggest later on the article that the one and the four categories are sort of the extremes, and the two and three are sort of mediating positions. So one and fours tend to want to sort of like hunker down and fight, and two and three tend to be a little bit more like, hey, let's try to find common ground. Yeah. And that's some of what creates the noise right now is that fours and ones feel like they're far apart from each other, you know, whether you think it's time to hunker down and fight for truth, or it's time to like become contrite and own all of our sins, that those are very different postures. Yes. And the twos and threes sort of are find themselves kind of in the middle of those. And so there is a, it's in your Venn diagram idea is somewhat helpful there.
Why did he divide this up into two different tables? Is it, was it just practical sense of there's more categories in the race topic than political and gender, or was there a purpose there? Am I missing something, or is it just a practical?
I don't know. Well, now we've got to get to his tables. Now he lists in his article some tables of like, hey, here's how these four would approach something. So let's take some fun categories. He has his first table is about race, and across the top, he's got five issues: white supremacy, systemic racism, police shootings, critical race theory, Black Lives Matter. Let's take the most hot button of those, which I think is Black Lives Matter. That's the one that sort of captures systemic racism, police shoot. I mean, it sort of captures a lot of these things.
Yeah.
So he would say that contrite people, their approach to Black Lives Matter is say it, wave it, wear it. The compassionate people, their approach is support the slogan, not the organization. The careful people, their approach to Black Lives Matter is Black lives are made in the image of God, but given the aims of the larger movement, using the phrase in an unqualified way is unwise. The courageous approach to Black Lives Matter is what about blue lives, unborn lives, all lives? So you can see that sort of that gives a sense of there's one issue and there's sort of four different ways of parsing out. What should we think about something like Black Lives Matter? And you probably have friends who are in all four of those categories. Yeah. If you're a Christian, you know people in your church or in your small group, maybe even that would sort of fall all along that spectrum. You can look at the article yourself if you want to read sort of how he parses out the rest of those. I'll jump down to the second table, which is politics and gender. And let's just take Trump on this one, because since that's in the past now, we can all sort of look back and go, oh yes, it doesn't feel quite as tense talking about it right now because he's no longer the president. So we can look back and say, oh yeah, remember when, right? Remember when people were very adamant about this a few months ago. Again, the contrite approach to Trump is no. The church's allegiance to Trump is the clearest sign of its spiritual bankruptcy. The compassionate approach to Trump, a matter of Christian liberty, but there are good reasons to criticize Trump. The careful approach to Trump, a matter of Christian liberty, but there are good reasons someone might have voted for Trump. The courageous approach to Trump, yes, he's not perfect, but he stood up to the anti-God agenda of the left. And again, you can see, you probably know people in your church who fall all along those four spectrums. What's helpful there is he's saying sometimes we think there was two categories, right? Pro-Trump, anti-Trump. But he's saying, nope, it was more nuanced than that. There's actually four different ways, because those two middle categories are saying, hey, there's Christian liberty here. You're free to vote wherever you want. But, you know, there are really good reasons to criticize Trump. Or, hey, Christian liberty, but there are some good reasons someone might have voted for Trump. So you can see those two middle positions are sort of trying to mediate and say, hey, we want to make room for freedom here, but I have concerns about, right, how we might be phrasing this. And then you've got the one and the four positions, which are either hard no on Trump or hard yes on Trump. And across this this table, by the way, the top categories are Trump, Christian nationalism, wearing masks, sexual abuse, and gender roles. The masked one is particularly interesting because it's so present tense, and it's like, yep, it just sort of maps right onto there. Yeah. And later in the article, he asked the question, why is it that if you know what someone thinks about mask wearing, you probably have a pretty good idea what they think about Christian nationalism or about systemic racism? He says, why is it that if you know what somebody thinks on one of these things, it tends to map on how they think about some other things? And again, his argument is because this is about an instinct or a sensibility about what we should do in the current moment related to all kinds of issues. And so it can't be boiled down to we just disagree about race or about politics or about gender or about mask wearing or about nationalism or about systemic racism, but that there's all of these things kind of map onto the same taxonomy in similar ways. So gentlemen around the table, do you feel like these tables are tapping into something that is accurate? In other words, would you say that he's right in that what divides us is more of an instinct on many things rather than an approach to one thing?
I do. I think it's really helpful. And he gets, after these tables, he gets to the some reasons as to why he gives the taxonomy and the schema, and one of them being understanding ourselves. And I think that's where this table is, or these, this taxonomy and these tables are most helpful for me to be aware of, okay, so this instinct then overlaps in these other areas and helps me understand why I might differ with family members or friends or whatever. And obviously there's the risk of being reductionistic in anything like this, where someone said, I don't want to be pigeonholed in any of these particular lines of this table or categories. But for me, it's really helpful.
Yeah. As I read through these tables, I've found myself in categories 2 and 3, bouncing back and forth in between those various cells and the table he's laid out here, and finding myself in the tension of the extremes of people that I do know within our church and within our family, and trying to help them see, hey, maybe it doesn't need to be as extreme as you're stating it. And so as he lays it out here, it becomes real clear, literally in black and white, seeing like, oh, this is, I feel the tension of this in real life. I think my concern is not so much with how he lays it out, but he calls them teams. And so instinctively I see this as, yes, this is kind of laid out in nice language, but he's really pointing out like these four different types of individuals see themselves pitted against each other. And so that's just kind of something that I was kind of troubled by as I was reading this, is like, oh, he's really pointing out here, we are divided. Like, we don't see ourselves as like, oh, we're the same people, but we just disagree. It's like, no, we're drawing lines in the sand based off these categories. So that's kind of concerning to me.
One of the things I thought was really helpful is, I mean, how he frames the whole thing, starting with, hey, like theologically, biblically, all these groups would probably in our camps agree on a lot of the same things on, you know, the Bible is the word of God, what Jesus' death on the cross did, all these things. Like, both of these tables are looking at race, politics, and gender. It's looking at culture and their approaches to culture. Which I think it's framing it really well in my mind as like the things that are making these teams respond differently is their view of culture as what is the problem and therefore what is the solution. It's not necessarily a different view on, you know, Christ's atonement or something. It's basically them, I don't know, looking at culture and what do they feel like is wrong? What's the problem? Bob, you pointed out that he frames it with why, like that's what he's trying to answer. And to one extent, I think this is helpful of like parsing it out and framing it. But I'm really curious to hear more that I don't think the article answers, but I don't know if it's necessarily intending to, of like, how have we gotten to the point where these four groups who believe a lot of the same biblical doctrine and the same theology have such vastly different approaches to culture and their reaction of like, their diagnosis of what's wrong with the culture and therefore how are we going to treat this problem is just completely different, even though their beliefs are all very similar.
Let me make a couple of observations and then maybe reflect historically for a minute. The observation is this: for listeners, I think this taxonomy is helpful to be able to identify which of these inclinations is more natural to you. Do you tend to be more contrite, compassionate, careful, or courageous? Because what it allows us to do is to realize that these are sort of instincts or sensibilities, and seeing them as such keeps me from moralizing things in a way that's unhelpful. So when I look at a question like systemic racism, okay, if I tend to be a person who's more contrite, I'm gonna want to go way further on that spectrum than if I'm someone who's more courageous. And so it may not be that one of us is right and one of us is wrong on how the church should approach that. We might have really different sensibilities here. And this helps us sort of be self-aware of, okay, here's how I tend to think about this, and here's how someone across the room tends to think about it. And there might be room for both of those approaches, or there might be benefit in the things that are pulling against each other on that issue. So I think this is helpful for self-awareness. and to give us charity toward one another, what DeYoung is doing here. I had a conversation just last week with a wonderful couple in our church who probably has a different sensibility than me, particularly on a few of these questions surrounding systemic racism and critical race theory. And one of the questions they asked me is, how come you haven't been more vocal about these issues? Like, why isn't our church like, you know, raising the fist in the air and sort of like being very declarative on these things? And I just explained to them, well, let me tell you sort of how I'm trying to assess this. And basically what I was saying is like, I kind of fall into the careful category here. And so I'm just going to want to listen well. I'm going to want to avoid speaking out quickly. I want to sort of take in information. I want to listen to lots of voices I trust. And as I describe that, they're like, oh, that's actually helpful to understand. It's not that you don't care about this issue. It's not that you don't think something matters here. It's that your approach to how to what the church should do in this moment is a little different than ours. And it helped to build a sense of like, okay, we actually don't see things dramatically differently, but there is a difference in how we think the church needs to move or act in this exact moment. Mm-hmm. So those are the kinds of conversations I think this table can be helpful with, is just to say, hey, sometimes when it feels like we're apart, we're actually not apart. We're a little different in how we would want to sort of invite the church to act. What I was asking as I was praying and prepping for this podcast, what I was asking myself is, what analogs are there to this? And why does it feel like this is more fractury than similar things in recent memory? I have a couple hypotheses that I want to put forward. One is, I suspect that the age of social media has made these divisions stark in ways that would not have been possible before. And I think the reason for that is social media tends to, social media doesn't tend to do this. People do this on right. social media, yeah. But I'm saying social media accelerates our tendency to make judgments and to sort of take sides. Because that's the nature of how the platform works.
And you don't want to get left behind in exactly. those judgments and those thoughts.
And so what I'm thinking is like, if it's very interesting to me to look at something like systemic racism and to say, hey, as we've talked about on this very podcast last year, right? Hey, there's really good questions the church should be asking here. And also there's open questions that I don't think are settled yet here. And so there's a conversation that should be happening. And it seems like actually the only thing people are interested in is, are you willing to call that thing over there systemic racism, or are you not? Or are you even willing to admit systemic racism is a category, or should we be fighting about whether it's a category? So it seems like we're sort of being backed into combative kinds of positions. And I just think that tendency is accelerated by social media and probably by politics. And if I think about the last, like Kevin DeYoung, you know, take the last, especially the Trump era, the last 5 years, 2016 till now, it seems to me that Christians, that in the past, things that Christians would have said, let's have a long conversation about that. Now, the space for that doesn't seem to exist in the same way, or we don't feel the freedom to do that. And here's the analog. If I dial the clock back to 2005, the year we planted Cormdale, that was at the height of the sort of emergent movement in the church, which was sort of this, it was a similar thing. It was about culture mostly. And now it had some theological anomalies too, but it was primarily churches and Christians trying to ask the question, how should the church relate to culture? And this whole movement of emergent people that were very odd in some ways, but we're asking really important questions that I think the church should have been asking. In 2005, Rob Bell's book, Velvet Elvis, came out, or Velvet Jesus, the very first book that Rob Bell ever wrote. And Rob Bell, as you can tell from the trajectory of his life, was just always a complicated person. And I think I had serious concerns about him from day one as far as where he landed theologically. But when that book came out, there was like a 2-year conversation about, hey, how should we assess the things that Rob Bell is saying, the places where he's pushing on orthodoxy, the places where he's challenging some cultural dynamics in the church? And it was just it felt like a very patient conversation. It was like, you don't have to have an opinion about Rob Bell's book, Velvet Jesus, on day one. Well, let's go read it. What'd you think of it? Did you like it or not like it? I have some concerns about it. Okay, well, let's, you know, the whole church at large, it seemed, had a conversation. And even there were conferences where it was like Rob Bell and other people point counterpoint. And let's like actually have a theological debate about these issues. It just seems to me that nothing like that has happened in the last 5 years about any of this stuff. Nor does it seem like there's sort of the freedom anymore to sort of have a slow conversation about some of these things. Something like, hey, how should we think about a question like the church's involvement with systemic racism, both where the church needs to acknowledge and repent, but also how should the church posture itself right now in the cultural moment that we're in related to that issue in the culture? That's a very interesting conversation that it feels like there's just not the space to have it in the same way. And I suspect that part of that is social media, part of that is political fragmentation, and part of that is, who knows, cultural factors. But it's just interesting to me to say, I actually think our tradition gives us the freedom to do that. And maybe if we just all slowed down and said, hey, these are, we might have four different sensibilities about how quickly we should be to move on a particular subject or issue, but let's feel free to have conversations about it. That freedom seems to not exist in the way that it did 15 years ago. That's just me as an old guy reflecting on my experience, something that seems analogous.
Bob, this whole article is reminding me of a few weeks ago in one of our staff meetings, you walked up to the whiteboard and drew a list of how to engage with people, especially in conflict, and what things to avoid and things to remember. And one of the things you said is basically like, don't assume motivation of the person, because that's like just that's going to kill conversation. If you just assume that I know why you did this, I know what you're trying to do, I know your intent. And you're talking more in the, you know, arena of interpersonal conflict, but reading this article, I feel like that also is a great, tool for just even this whole discussion of, as we're talking about this kind of posture and like, that a lot of this isn't just a disagreeing on facts, but it's like, you probably have a sensibility that's different. Reading this chart is really helpful to be like, okay, no, like maybe your judgment of another person's motivations, why they think the things they do, might not actually be accurate, and like having the humility to actually be like, how about let's talk about that? Let's say it, like, tell me why you think this. I'm assuming that you're not trying to, you know, I'm assuming you're not trying to burn down the country, or that you're intentionally, you know, out to be, you know, a racist or something. Like having the space to not read motivations into people's ideologies and hearing them of like, explain to me why you think this. This article was really helpful for me, putting everything in the best light of like, well, what do they think?
Yes. I do think it's important that we, it used to be just basic Christian wisdom, but it seems like that has eroded a little bit. The idea of I shouldn't judge someone else's motives. I should give them a chance to explain why they think what they think and how they arrived at that position. And for there to be healthy debate. You asked before we turned the microphones on, Isaiah, do you think this fragmentation is real? Is it going to result in like, actually sort of different tribes and groups, or is it just sort of a moment that we're in that's going to resolve itself? I think I lean toward the second. I think it's actually a little bit of the moment that we're in. And I don't suspect that actually anyone in any of these four camps is actually going to say, we're so convinced on this, that we're right on this issue that we're going to go form our own tribe. I think this is a conversation that's a little more fraught than it needs to be, because of the cultural moment that we're in. But I actually think the conversation about race is important and has some really good fruit from it, despite some of the obnoxiousness on both sides of the ones and the fours, you know, the contrite people and the courageous people sort of who really want to duke it out with each other. I think it's an important conversation. I think the same is true for some of our conversations about gender, for some of our conversations about even Christians and politics. So it feels to me like I think this is going to resolve, but only if we all sort of do the work that Kevin DeYoung is urging us to do here of saying, hey, where do I sort of, what are my instincts here? And how do I need to look across the room and say, oh, it's okay for you to have a different instinct there, but let's have a conversation.
As I was thinking through even some of the references to history here, it does seem that, yes, while this is a more fraught conversation right now, this has been what the church has discussed since its inception.
That's a good point.
Like, interaction with culture. What is that going to look like? And I go back to the tradition I'm most familiar with, and fundamentalism. It was all about reaction to culture and what different churches and groups would do in reaction to that. And so as I'm approaching this, and I guess that's where that question was birthed out of, you know, that split between fundamentalism and evangelicalism, and now this conversation that's ongoing. So I think your words regarding the patience and the slowing down, and let's have the conversation, let's not assume motivation, and let's assume, even at the end here, I really appreciate how Kevin ends the article, where he says, let's have a renewed focus on the glory of Christ. Yes, there are real differences on how these four different groups are approaching this cultural moment. But if what brings us together is really the most important thing, the matter of first importance, the gospel, if that's what unites us, then we should be able to work through these other issues, at least to the point of saying, well, we disagree, but God bless you and pray for your ministry and move on.
Not on Twitter. We have to have those conversations in person.
Yes.
Well, and I was going to say, my more cynical side would say this, that part of what makes this toxic is that actually the way you build coalitions in our modern day is to double down. Mm-hmm. And so like what I see happening that's not helpful is that I think on all sides of this issue, there can be sort of like a doubling down on, hey, we need to fight for or against X. And the more that becomes the posture, you sort of have to do that to build a platform, to get donors, and to sort of generate interest, which is why politics is the way it is right now. And I hope we can write that beginning in the church and say, hey, no, that's not how the church sorts its issues out, right? We don't do that by doubling down and demonizing our opponents. Mm-hmm. We do that if there's heresy, we need to call it heresy.
Absolutely.
But that's in a different category. That's theological and doctrinal. And, you know, maybe some of these issues stray into that. And if so, we need to have those conversations. But when it's a secondary question of how the church relates to culture, there's lots of room there for debate, discussion, disagreement, healthy back and forth, applying the scriptures in compelling ways to that question. So we sort of need to resist the tendency to tribalize. But as I approach this as a cynic, I say, but I don't have a whole lot of hope in that category because that's how people raise money. So
it does almost seem like there's a weaponizing of these positive terms, where at the beginning we all acknowledge these are good words that we would all want to define us to some degree. But when you begin to take one and weaponize it against the others, well, mm-hmm. you don't have the courage you need to. Well, you don't have the contrition you need to. Mm-hmm. You don't have the compassion, the carefulness. That's where it's saddening. There's just a level of grief looking at the situation going, okay, the unity that should reflect or should be reflected in the church, in the body of Christ, when we begin to weaponize good things against other parts of the body, it's not a good witness to the world, and it doesn't reflect the glory of Christ.
And there's something here. Maybe our best approach is just to enjoy life. Just Ecclesiastes, you know, like, man, enjoy life all your days on the earth, right? Because
eat more oatmeal cream pies.
Yeah. Well, there's this sense of like, hey, no one's going to sort this out tomorrow on Twitter, nor are you going to sort it out in a gospel community where you have an argument with someone who has a different sensibility here. You know what the church needs to do is say, hey, you know what? Jesus is on the throne. All these issues matter. There's a right and a wrong answer to them. Who knows what they are? We'll continue to sort it out as we move forward and trust him. Let's attend to the most important things, which is our communion with the Lord Jesus, our brotherhood and sisterhood with one another, the convictional clarity of the local church. You know, there's a way that all these things can just increase anxiety and frustration. Yeah. And what you see in fundamentalism in its worst forms is that there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of defensiveness and a lot of sort of othering, you know, and doubling down on, you know, and actually that's not us at our best. Us at our best is winsome, charitable, not super concerned about what's happening in the world because we know Jesus is in charge of it all, and winsomely engaged in things in the world around us, but not in a way that assumes that tomorrow everything's going to hell in a handbasket, or tomorrow if we make the right decision, you know, the kingdom is going to come, but some measure of charitableness all the way around. All right, so we'll post the article in the show notes. Again, it's from March 9th, so it's a month old already. But I think Kevin DeYoung has done us a service here in at least trying to name something that is really going on. And I think you will find it helpful in identifying your own sensibilities and intuitions, and also having some freedom to identify the sensibilities and intuitions of people around you who might disagree on various things. So thank you, Kevin DeYoung. And thank you, friends, for this conversation. It's been good to engage this article with you. Listeners, I hope you find it useful.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in. And we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We always love to hear from you, the listener, so send us your thoughts, questions, or future podcast topic ideas to podcast@cdomaha.com. And we'll see you again next Wednesday for another Wednesday conversation.
Hey, by the way, oatmeal cream pies are amazing.
And gross at the same time.
They are.